Craft a kind of world that we all can share and prosper in and live in. And so thank you so much for all who entered into the conversation and shared. We appreciate your engagement. We appreciate you supporting public radio. So if you have the opportunity, of course, become a member of KBOO. We appreciate your support. Thank you.
This has been Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. Thank you so much for tuning in. Happy Earth Day. Go out there and make your city a cleaner, sustainable, and more just place to live. For Tracy Simmons, my name is Abe Proctor. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll be back at you next week.
He roller coaster, he got early warning, he got muddy water, he want mojo filter, he said.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO's Earth Day Marathon comes from its members and from Symbiop Garden Shop, a local worker-owned ecological garden shop and landscaping cooperative specializing in regionally native plants and climate chaos resilient food systems. Symbiop is located at 34th and Southeast Powell Boulevard. More info at symbiop.com.
This old creek town appears empty, except for the trees and the story of how wind will come to clean the earth of the takers who took and will never give back. One day my grandfather used to sing, a fresh world will rise up to take the place of the society didn't love the earth. We lost ourselves when we crossed that river, my grandfather used to say. He would smoke to the east, northwest, and south, touch the earth and the sky. He'd be standing in the kitchen, there'd be no one listening. Pass this love on, he'd say, who knows how to bend, it will never break. It's the only thing with a give and take.
Good morning, good morning. This is Jacqueline Keeler, and I'm here as part of the Earth Day Marathon, and we'll be discussing the earth is our mother, and in the age of Trump, and MAGA. And some of you may know me. I've been co-hosting a show once a month with Paul Roland, and he had me on once a month as a co-host for his show Wednesday Talk Radio, and I'm a Native American journalist and author living here in the Portland area, and a citizen of the Navajo Nation, and born for the Yankton Sioux people. My father was Yankton Sioux, and for any Navajos listening out there, my clan is Kia'ani. So I guess today I wanted to share with you an interview I did actually nearly 5 years ago with a really noted Native leader and elder of the Cheyenne Nation, Suzanne Harjo, who really led the fight against mascots. And you know, so you'll hear more about her in the introduction in the clip. But I wanted to really look at the ways in which Trump and his administration, both Trump, both of his times in office, have really impacted Native people and our mother. And I don't know if any of you have heard me talk about this before, but you know, for Native people, and I go through this in my book Standoff, where I examine both the standoffs in 2016 of Standing Rock and also of the Bundy takeover of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge here in Oregon. You know, Native people, our identity, our political identity, is really derived from our sovereignty, from our notion, from our peoplehood, right? And the definition I use for that is that a people, which is what we normally call ourselves, the people, that's the Navajo people call themselves Diné, which is a word that means the people in our language. And we really see ourselves as being born of our mother and our father, right? Our mother, the earth, and our father, the sky. And our identity and our peoplehood is based in that relationship. It's crucial to it. And I make a real contrast in my book between that notion, where it's based in a relationship with the earth, with all the people, in people meaning not just human people, but all life of our mother, I make a contrast between that and that of a colonist, someone who's come here to exploit the land. And so we had this conversation actually during COVID with Suzanne Harjo, and of course we were talking about the effects of the lockdown on the earth, on that Earth Day 2020, and sort of how we could reflect upon how Native people have used or have lived with, I think, using the term, even using the earth or using the environment. It really connotes a very specific mindset, which is really alien to Indigenous people in the Americas, and I suppose around the world as well. And we'll go ahead and start the interview now.
Our guest today, you can hear, is Suzanne Harjo. She hails from the Cheyenne and Hodogie Muscogee Nations, and she is a poet, writer, lecturer, curator, and policy advocate. Over the past 50 years, she has helped Native people recover more than 1 million acres of land, including many sacred places. She has developed key laws to promote and protect Native nations, sovereignty, children, arts, culture, and language. Ms. Harjo is the former executive director of the National Congress of American Indians. She has also served on the Native American Policy Committee for Senator Barack Obama's presidential campaign and as an advisor to the transition in 2008-2009, and is a 2014 recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. You can see her receiving from Obama. And she is president of the Morningstar Institute, a national Native rights organization founded in 1984 for Native people's traditional and cultural advocacy, arts promotion, and research. Ms. Harjo is one of seven Native people who filed the 1992 landmark case Harjo et al. The Pro Football, Inc. against the disparaging name of the Washington football team. She also organized an identical lawsuit, Black Horse et al. The Pro Football, Incorporated, which was filed in 2006 by six Native young people. This is a long bio, but I think it's worth noting. So I have one more paragraph. It is also a guest curator and general editor for the National Museum of the American Indian exhibit and book, Treaties, Great Nations in Their Own Words. She was Seeing Red co-producer and drama and literature director for the Pacifica Network's WBAI-FM radio in New York City. Harjo was news director of the American Indian Press Association and founding co-chair of the Howard Simmons Fund for American Indian Journalists. And she's also an award-winning columnist for Indian Country Today. So welcome, Susan.
Thank you.
That's
sorry
a lot.
I had to read all of that.
No, it's awesome. It's wonderful to recount all of that. So
what a wonderful thing to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So today is Earth Day, and it's such an unusual one with everyone in lockdown, not just here, but across the world. So, and there are these unprecedented news reports indicating that the Earth is rewilding. And the skies are getting clear without all of us driving cars and polluting the air. So, Suzanne, what do you think of all this? Yeah.
At Union Station, I was an onlooker, a participant. It was in my neighborhood. I lived in the village. And it was right across from where I was going that day, which was the factory, which was the artist Andy Warhol's famous place where there were lots of happenings. But the biggest happening of the day was Earth Day taking place there in Manhattan, New York, and all over the world, really. But what makes this one really special is that it's a real gift to Mother Earth. We've been so awful to her, we humans, that and her children, all her children, that she's been to shake us off her. She's been trying to drown us, to burn us off. She's sent volcanoes and earthquakes and tornadoes, and nothing has worked. And now she sent a virus. And it's clever, and it's keeping us indoors. And I love that the picture that has gone around the world 1,000 times of the Himalayas that can be seen now for the first time in 30 years.
Wow.
That's an extraordinary photo that you can see the tops of the Himalayas. And I feel like I've never seen them before in a photo. And to see photos of coyotes walking around, not necessarily Yosemite, even those are great photos, but San Francisco, and to see buffalo walking across the roads and in various places that you don't expect to see buffalo, tells you that the world is slowing down, that people can breathe easier. The seismologists tell us that there are fewer earthquakes at this time, that the earth is trembling less from the constant motion, especially the road traffic, heavy vehicles, cars, and heavier ones. It was getting to a point where in Oklahoma, which is my home state, there were 5 earthquakes a day. When I was growing up, there were never earthquakes. Now, even the oil and gas industry confesses error. They say it was their fault. They brought the earthquakes with the fracking. And that before that methodology, they didn't have earthquakes. So I think we have inadvertently given Mother Earth and the rest of her children a break. And I hope not a whole lot more people have to die in order for all of us to get that point profoundly.
And but it was pretty amazing. And to think that's happening all over the world now, I think I guess it is sort of a birthday gift. If you can actually consider Earth Day a birthday for the
an Earth Day gift.
Yes, exactly, for our mother, you know. And I think, yeah, I find it pretty, it's a pretty extraordinary thing. I mean, as I noted before, this has never happened before. All the countries on Earth shutting everyone staying home, all the humans. It's never happened. This is unprecedented.
Suzanne, if
you don't mind me. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was wondering if you don't mind me asking a follow-up question. My name's Mark. I'm an editor with...
Yeah, I just want, this is Jacqueline Keeler in the present today. I'd like to introduce the program again. This is a special part of the KBOO's Earth Day Marathon. And my show is called The Earth is Our Mother in the Age of Trump and MAGA. And this interview took place 5 years ago and with Suzanne Harjo, a very important Native leader in this country. And she does mention that she attended the first Earth Day in 1970 when she was in New York City. And this is the 25th anniversary. And I think it was one of the largest events in the world. I mean, millions and millions of people attended, I think. And I think almost like 100, it was quite high. And so we're discussing that during lockdown, I think sometimes we forget. We forget what it was like, and it's sort of interesting to rehear this conversation now. Have we learned anything from that experience? Have we learned anything from giving our mother a break from that notion as a group? And of course, now we're all dealing with the constant shock and disruptive and destructive policies of the Trump administration. But maybe we should think about the time that we spent together, you know, fighting for humanity, staying home, and giving our mother a rest. So go ahead, continue.
I
was wondering if you don't mind me asking a follow-up question. My name's Mark. I'm an editor with Pollination. It's great to have you here. In addition to this time kind of showing us what can happen when we stop our destructive habits that we're kind of addicted to as misguided humans, do you also think this could be an opportunity for Native people to show more about their philosophy and their approach to relationships to land that are guided more on responsibility and reciprocity? I mean, is that something you're thinking about too?
Absolutely. If only people would listen to what indigenous people in the Amazon have to say, we would be a lot closer to world peace, literally, than we are now. To listen to what they say about not setting fire to the Amazon, to listen to what they say about the leader of Brazil declaring war on indigenous peoples. These are grotesque things that are happening. And what you're seeing, a friend of mine, Dr. Chelis Glendening, who's a wonderful psychologist and an author, lives in Colombia, and she said that what you're seeing from the ashes, from the Amazon, are ashes, and you're seeing the animals coming out disoriented and charred and burned, and that it's really fearful, and those are the ones who made it. So someone has to start paying attention to what the Native people have been saying all over the world. If you burn the trees that the bats live in Australia and China and the Amazon, you're going to have a concentration of bats in China. You're going to have a concentration of bats everywhere. And if they happen to carry a virus that jumps the species, guess what you have? You have the novel coronavirus. Of course, no one knows that for sure, but they think it comes from bats and that it did jump into humans. Now, the bat people, the bat men and bat women, would tell you that the bats are good, and they are great for eating mosquitoes, and that's great. But they will tell you that it's also possible that it jumped the species from humans to bats. More scientists than not go with the bats to humans, and how that happened, they don't know yet. everyone has theories, whether it was ingested in some way or what exactly happened. Was it dinner? Was it some other method? No one really knows for sure, but they're pretty sure that it came from bats. We'll just trace those huge fires that have taken place from California to Australia and the Amazon to England to everywhere around the world. And they are unleashing millions and millions and millions of bats all over the world, carrying multiple viruses. So what we know as indigenous peoples is we've seen this before, not this exact thing, but we've seen things that come from people from across the waters who eat their pets or live with their dinner in too close proximity. So we've experienced smallpox, we have experienced measles, the epidemics that were pandemics up and down this hemisphere, taking millions and millions of people, hundreds of millions of people in what's now North, South, and Central America. So we have seen this before, and we know that it always comes with a second turn, and maybe a third turn, and maybe a fourth turn, and that it diminishes as it goes, till pretty soon you build up an immunity. And we even have songs about this. We have history about this. We have seen this before. We know it. And how did we survive it? By coalescing, by sticking together, by appreciating each other, and by continuing to be the people we were meant to be. So I think there are a lot of things that others might learn from us.
Hi, Susan. This is Kayla. I do videos for Sovereign Stories, which is educational shorts on Native issues to try to get more understanding and have more in-depth conversations like these with more people. And I kind of wanted to ask you a question too, since, you know, a point that you're bringing up about indigeneity and taking care of the world, I think that's a really important piece that gets lost a lot when we talk about how we are seeing a cleaner world right now, because it almost seems to translate to a cleaner world equals no people. And I think it leaves out that piece of indigenous caretaking in the examples that you gave. And it sort of allows us to ignore how our systems have been compromised in a way. I fear sometimes that it seems like positive changes are happening, or are we just adapting the same old irresponsibilities? The one point I wanted to make is, you know, the U.S. has 15% of the global emissions usually, and about 10% of that has to do from the agricultural industry. And I know agriculture is a big conversation, and we're seeing images of produce not being sold and getting thrown away and things like that. I mean, do you think this is possibly an opportunity for us to transform our food systems based off of indigenous knowledge?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's such an important topic and such an important point that you make and question that you ask. Our friend and protector of the salmon in the Northwest, Billy Frank Jr., with great pride showed me the estuary that he was able to have rehabilitated from almost dry land to become what's now called the Billy Frank Jr. Estuary and a spawning ground for salmon. That's where they like to spawn, or in the wetlands. And that's where they're kind of free from most predators, from the sea lions and the Russian and the Japanese trawlers off the 200-mile limit and everyone else. And then the ones that make it, if they can make it to that kind of wetland, to that kind of estuary, and spawn, they're offspring have a greater chance of making it back to that same place after spending their teenage years in the Pacific Northwest, up around Alaska, and then making the trip back and coming up that same stream. That's the kind of thing that he did in his lifetime several times over, and we should be trying to do that. Some of it just requires stream clearance, for example. But another question to ask is, what grows here naturally? Yes, we all ate corn. We know that. Millions of scientists have spent their life coming to the conclusion that we ate corn one time. What else? I mean, that'd be a pretty dull diet, although in all our languages, we have at least one word, and some have 20 for the word corn and corn recipes. What else grew here? Turnips, potatoes, most of the world's food. As in 70% of the world's food came from here, from it was cultivated, not just sprang up naturally, but was cultivated from the natural products of this hemisphere, of this red quarter of Mother Earth. And that is what we need to rediscover in our backyards and in the back 40 on any kind of land that we have is we need to know how to find water. We need to know how to make water available. We need to know the food, and we need to start growing it. We need to start doing that so that we will regain the freedom we had that comes from being in good health. Haters and racists and bigots will jump on anything to make their point.
Yeah, I just wanted to, this is Jacqueline Keeler again in the presence, and I'd like to let you all know that you're here listening to KBOO's Earth Day Marathon, and I'm your host, Jacqueline Keeler. I interviewed noted Native leader Suzanne Harjo, and these are some of her thoughts 5 years ago on Earth Day. And she mentions some of you may know of Billy Frank Jr., who was a noted Native American environmental leader and advocate for treaty rights here in the Pacific Northwest. He was a member of the Nisqually tribe, and he led the fight for fishing rights for local tribes here in the Pacific Northwest. And he led a series of fish-ins, which were really the beginning of the Red Power movement, of the fight for Native rights nationally. And so, and he's still a very beloved figure, and he has passed away, but he is very respected. So she just highlighted his work and the importance of what Native people can teach the rest of the country on Earth Day. So, all right, good.
So this wasn't someone who just woke up one day and said, "Oh, COVID-19, let's hate Navajos." This was someone who hated Navajos, and here's an excuse, COVID-19. Mm-hmm. Good, let's jump on them for a change. And anytime you hear that language that is promoted right from the Oval Office, unfortunately, of infestation, and where this was the language that motivated the Proud Boy to drive in Texas, how many, 9 hours to get to El Paso to shoot people who were brown because they were infesting our country and keeping the white people from making America great again. So whenever I hear that word infest or anything like that, I know where that's coming from. They're equating us with animals, and yes, it's deliberate, and yes, it's said behind closed doors in lots of places in Arizona where they wouldn't like Native people to know that they're saying such things. What makes this one different is that it...
Hi, this is Jacqueline Keeler again from the present. And the racist shooter that Suzanne has mentioned is, of course, in the news today, Patrick Crucios, who shockingly killed 23 people in a Walmart in El Paso, Texas in 2019, was recently, he pled guilty, and he has also been sentenced to life in prison. And there's a whole, his victims are actually engaged in sort of forgiving him, or not forgiving him, but trying to end the hate, which is a very interesting thing to note today. And of course, her words about hatred and racial hatred being a part of this system of racial domination in this country is still really a part of our lives today, with Trump constantly underlining that. And of course, the taking of Texas was part of that. And I'll discuss a little bit more at the end of this, sort of the Jacksonian heritage of the United States, and the sort of and how that the notion of freedom, the freedom from restraint that embodied, including, you know, their right to do anything they want to protect this very white supremacist privileged society that we've built. And I'll discuss that more. All right, go ahead.
Emerges in a time of polarization in our country and hatred, and a campaign that's being waged between campaigner and virus. It's not even two political parties. This is campaigner and virus. So it serves the interest of one. And in the meantime, the virus just keeps on going. It's very smart. We have to respect this creature that's been unleashed on us and that has become a part of some of us. And we have to protect the people from being exploited. We just have to be on our watch, very cautious, and to know that we're going to survive this. And how do we know that? Because we are here, and that in itself is a miracle. And that suggests that we are going to be here for a long time, because we have understood ourselves how to adapt as peoples. Otherwise, things won't be right. And for the Cheyennes, one of those things is the buffalo skull in the Sundance, which is there to represent the whole of the gist of the Cheyenne people for the next year. So everyone watches very carefully while that's carried, just to see if it shakes or if someone stumbles or if there's any disturbance. But if it's smooth, then you know, okay, next year is going to be good. So it plays a central role, not the pivotal role, but it's very important. And one year, because the white people tried to kill off all the Buffalo Nation there and keep Native peoples on the reservations, there were no buffaloes. So they're saying, well, how can we have the Sundance with no buffalo skull? And so the answer was that for this year and this year only, going to use this cow skull, and the leader of the Sundance would declare it a buffalo skull for the Sundance. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing that we know how to do, and that's passed on to us, to say how important our ways are, how important our spirituality is, how important our traditions are, and the meaning and the essence. So I hope that is something that helps our people, or many peoples who are going into ceremonial times with the new year. This is spring. This is when everything's coming up, and when you can see the sky again and see the stars at night, and everything's configured perfectly for birth and for regeneration and renewal. So I really take comfort in that. The greatest evidence to me that we're going to survive is the fact that we have survived.
And what I know that you've worked really hard to change the stereotypes and the mascots and the sort of tokenism of our representation.
It's part of the same virus. When you have sexist and racist imagery, it really is part of the same virus of hate. What does that have to do with the Indian butter maiden? Well, the Indian butter maiden has been a toy of white people for a long time. It's a toy of racism, a symbol that has belittled not just Native women, but all women. And to the point where boys and men in America and elsewhere, I guess, I've never seen people do this elsewhere, but boys and men in the United States do a little trick with the cover so that the Indian butter maiden's knees become her breasts. And that gets a big ha 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 when it's done. Now, does that have something to do, does that objectification have something to do with the demeaning and alarming behavior at this time toward Indigenous women and girls and people in the LGBTQ community? Is that the same syndrome? Yeah, it is. If you scratch racism, you scratch sexism, you scratch dehumanization, you find their commonality. And whenever you see it and say, oh, this is like that, you have to take action to get rid of it. And when you see this administration being so hateful toward Native people, so hateful toward important sacred places, so hateful toward cultural rights of everyone, and so prone to the stereotyping of peoples that we're somehow genetically prone to the virus. You can't have that conversation about high rates in this or that world, among this or that kind of people, without talking about poverty, without talking about systemic failures of health delivery systems, without access, without talking about the lack of access to health care. All of these things have to be factored in, and lifestyle. What do we all have in common? That we live with each other. We live intergenerationally, more so than our white people in this country who are mostly nuclear family. A lot of us live in that way too, but there's a lot of living, especially seasonally, intergenerationally, close quarters. And that's something that has served us well for Native people. I think it's been a survival tactic and technique for other people of color as well. So I see it all as one continuous issue and one continuous adversary that has to be brushed aside or pushed aside or dealt with in some way so that we can go on to the next thing. And pretty soon we will have rid ourselves of this category of whatever it might be, stereotypes, of this category of privileging oil and gas development over wind and solar. So we have a lot of work to do. We have a whole lot of work to do, and we have work on ourselves to do. But I think we have less work on ourselves to do than more to teach others, more to help others than perhaps the greater society realizes.
Great. So you've been listening to an interview I did about 5 years ago with Suzanne Harjo, who is a really noted and respected Native leader. She's a member of the Cheyenne Nation. And those were her thoughts on Earth Day, which she attended the very first Earth Day in 1970 in New York City. And now, of course, we have the 25th anniversary here today. That year, the 20th anniversary, when I interviewed her, was the largest online sort of a celebration or group. I think over 100 million people participated, and it was during the pandemic. So I think coming out of, I think a lot of times we're in such shock day by day what's happening with the Trump administration. It's hard to keep track of it all. I am a journalist, and I'm working on a piece about Trump and Native people. It's been hard to do it, finish it for the San Francisco Chronicle, because things keep changing, keep evolving. And of course, what I've really had to contend, my book Standoff, I really tried to look at what was the cause of these two very different fights that were going on. One was for Native people, for Native lands, for protecting the water and the earth. And the other one was with the exemplified by the Bundy family, a family of ranchers who were in constant armed standoffs with the federal government in different parts of the country for different reasons, and were declaring that their rights were based on the fact that their horse nibbled a bit of grass and therefore created this Eden in Clark County outside Las Vegas, and therefore that gave them the rights to all of this public land. I think about 500,000 acres. They only own 160 acres, but they're claiming all this land for their own personal use and have used it without paying for over, I think about going on 30 years now. And they were supported by a large group of armed, mostly white people. And to me, the militarization and the militias, I should say, that have risen up and who Trump constantly, you know, sort of supports. And in fact, he did pardon the Proud Boys and other folks who had stood up during the Capitol insurrection and harmed, you know, many people attacking the Capitol to keep him in office. And of course, now we are faced with a constitutional crisis as well. And I'm trying to puzzle all this out still. I'm working on a sort of an updated sort of response to what's going on. I think my book came out in 2021, so that was about 4 years ago now. And here we have a second Trump administration. And I've been rereading a book that I think is quite, I think it's very good for an understanding of America. And that book is The End of the Myth by Greg Grandin, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America. And it also won the 2020 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction, and looks at the role of the frontier from the American Revolution to the presidential election of 2016. And my book Standoff does have a chapter about the American Revolution and highlights something that a lot of people are not that familiar with, the fact that before the Revolutionary War, there was, of course, many of you have probably learned about the French and Indian War, which a lot of the founding fathers participated in. But what you may not realize is that war was actually started by George Washington as a young man. He was sent out west, sent out to the Ohio Valley, leading a militia from the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia, a colony at the time of Great Britain, And so I guess then it was just England. It wasn't United Kingdom yet. But and he so he went out there and started World War Zero. That's what they call the French and Indian War. In Europe, it's called the 7 Years' War. But it is often called by historians World War Zero because it was the first kind of world war. And it was really started by a young man named George Washington, who was out there with a bunch of armed compatriots. And he basically took, I guess he killed a French diplomat. And this was an international incident. And what was the real motivating factor was, of course, the land, sort of the hunger for land in colonial America. And the idea that the right to take more land was crucial to their identity as colonists. It was defining. And of course, a lot of the elites I refer to the Revolutionary War as a war of the elites, because really all the founding fathers, as I was going through their biographies and I was writing the book, they were all some of the wealthiest men in the country, right? And they were all members of these land companies, like the Ohio Land Company, which was the right to, they were basically already speculating on land, Indian land that had not been handed over. And I think I don't know if you've seen, a lot of Native people have quoted, really focus on a part of the Declaration of Independence, which calls us merciless Indian savages, right? And this is a reference to the fact that in the settlement of the French and Indian War, they agreed to basically to not allow the colonists to invade Indian land. So there was the Proclamation Line of 1763, which went along the Appalachian Mountains and declared that the colonists had to stay east of there. They could no longer go west into Indian land. And of course, this outraged them, and obviously outraged the elites as well, because they were going to deal and sell and buy. They'd already after the French Indian War, George Washington went and purchased sort of bounty warrants, which were payment to soldiers in land. And a lot of it was in the Ohio Valley that was given out. And he purchased them from his men. And he owned, I don't know, something like 20 or 30,000 acres. And so when they went into this war, they were fighting for something, and they got it, right? And so the end of the myth really looks at what happens when there is no more frontier, and what's the frontier mean to the American mind. And I think this is really relevant when we're looking at all the ways in which a lot of the fight that the Bundys and other sort of far-right Americans, and I suppose a lot of Republicans, what they really view as crucial is their right to freedom, right? And they quote the Constitution. And in his book, he has a really interesting incident that happened in 1811, where he wasn't the president then, but Andrew Jackson was stopped on the Natchez Trace. And because Native nations were viewed as nations, Americans had to have passports to travel through their territory. And this so in and Jackson, who was actually leading a bunch of chain slaves, black people held in bondage, in a kind of a chain gang, and he was being made to give papers to prove that he was, show his passport and show his papers of ownership and all this stuff. And he was enraged, and he declared that he did not have to do that. And he pulled out, allegedly in one of the stories, he actually pulled out a copy of the Constitution, right, that he was carrying around. And if you know anything about the Bundys, a lot of these militia people, they carry around these constitutions, and they're always talking about the Constitution, even as, they are basically taking apart the Constitution. And so, so he really looks at that point where Jackson challenged that, and this he really is able to identify that the idea was that he writes, mobilized to defend a system of racial domination. The ideal of a limited federal government is itself inescapably racialized. is an extension of that resentment unique to white American supremacy carried forward since at least the Paxton Boys, the idea that the central government wasn't doing enough to protect settlers, that indeed it was hostile to settlers, and that settlers had to take matters into their own hands. And this is very similar to the kind of mindset that went behind the Revolutionary War, where, you know, the elites on this side of the Atlantic Ocean, you know, were taking on the elites on the other side, and they benefited enormously, and that this was their right to do that. Jacksonians understood freedom as freedom from restraint, including, as Andrew Jackson himself insisted on the Natchez Trace, from authorities telling them they couldn't slave or settle. And so it's this idea of a freedom from restraint, I think, is really core to the American identity, the white American identity. And I think you see this, I like to break things down to these really sort of almost like the building blocks, and what I call in my book, I call it the sort of these algorithms that sort of drive forward a lot of what we see going around us. I think a lot of times we end up sort of having to constantly react, like with the Trump administration, react to every terrible thing they do. But I think we have to sometimes step back and look at why are they doing this, and begin to address, like, how can we create another sort of sense of self for Americans that is far more unifying, that isn't so based on, you know, otherism, whether it's, you know, calling, you know, labeling people who are undocumented as illegal, and even and you know, addressing Native people's concerns in a very derogatory way, and so I'm actually working on a piece about Judge Boasberg right now, and he's very crucial right now in fighting against the Trump administration's attempt to basically do away with due process in handling people that they're these allegations and you know, illegal renditions, extra legal renditions of residents of the United States, but at the same time, he is the same federal judge who denied the Dakota Access, the Lakota and Dakota people at Standing Rock, their rights, and allowed the pipeline to be built, right? And so there's a sense of, like, the structure, how does it help us? How does it act against us? And so I think, you know, looking back at my conversation 5 years later with Suzanne Harjo, it's always really interesting to see, you know, where have we come? What have we done with different opportunities that we've had, and what can we carry forward from that time period? So I think that idea that what is Americanism about, and why is it acting the way it is something that I've been really trying to contend with on this Earth Day, 2025. And I found another really interesting quote in his book, The End of the Myth, Grandin's book. He writes about more than a century. So he's quoting in the early 1950s, the Mexican author and diplomat Octavia Paz, who basically made the point that the American Revolution is a permanent revolution. Paz went on, a nonstop expulsion of all, quote, elements foreign to the American essence, and a, quote, constant invention of itself. And anything that stands in the way of that invention, anything that is, quote, in any way irreducible or inassimilable to perpetuate creation, be it Native American, Spanish America, or history itself, is, quote, not American. And so I think trying to understand because, you know, even as we look at Earth Day, you know, what kind of progress have we made, and why is it that the fight against, really contending with climate change, with the kind of impact that the kind of carbon-based energy sources, why is it that they don't understand it? And yeah, you have Trump in power, and he is, of course, touting coal. And I'm ashamed to say that even my own Navajo Nation leader, president, has basically excited about this coal thing, because we have coal that's been mined in a really horrible way. It's the mining on the Navajo Nation has been a constant source of trauma for Navajo people, and it actually resulted in the largest methane cloud, having those large coal-fired power plants in the just north of our tribe, and you could see the huge methane cloud from space. And yet, most Navajos, for most of the 20th century, and even now, did not have electricity or running water. I think it's there's been improvements, but I think still 30% of Navajos do not have running water on the Navajo Nation, which, as I've noted many times, is about the size of Ireland, and has a population of about 200,000 people. And so that's some of the questions that I have. And but I guess I'm coming to the end of our time here. So I wanted to thank you all for listening to that interview that I had with Suzanne Harjo. And thank you for looking today during Earth Day about, you know, about our mother and our relationship to our mother, and the role that the system of racial domination has played in bringing us to this point today of really tragic climate change. And I'd like to say today there's other shows coming up. The next one coming up at 10 a.m. is Rockin' Out with DJ Fluorite, and 11 o'clock Voices of Vision. And 1:30, Nukes or No Nukes, the Human Environmental Cost of a Standoff. I definitely want to listen to that one. I've been working on a book about Hanford, the nuclear devastation there in Washington State, just upriver from us. So thank you very much. And I hope that you have a wonderful Earth Day. Hajonisli.
Grandfather flew like smoke to the sky side of earth. He left us here in this place he blessed. What stories he carried, what laughter wrapped memory. Now I'm standing in the kitchen, and I can hear him singing. Pass this love on, he'd say. It knows how to bend, it will never break. It's the only thing with a give and take. The more it's used, the more it makes. That love's a bridge that will cross the river home. He'd be standing in the dark with no one listening. How time blows steadily through the trees. How time blows steadily through the city. Thank you.
are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your Portland dial, KBOO.FM on your everywhere on earth internet dial. Stay safe, stay sane, stay tuned.